WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Writer William Kittredge grew up on a cattle ranch in the West, in Oregon. His grandparents were pioneers. He grew up with the myth that the white settler owned the West, absolutely and morally. They brought law and order to the West, shed blood to settle it, and it was rightfully theirs. But as Kittredge got older, he realized that this myth ignores the genocide of the Native Americans and ignores the ways in which many whites destroyed the ecology of the land they settled. In the American West, Kittredge says, we are struggling to revise our dominant mythology. William Kittredge is one of the writers at the forefront of that struggle. He sold his family cattle ranch in 1967 when he was in his mid-30s. He's since become a writer and a professor of English at the University of Montana. He writes about the myths of the American West and tries to tell the true story of the land where he grew up. He's even co-written a series of Western genre novels under the pseudonym of Owen Rountree. His latest collection of stories is titled We Are Not in This Together. His latest collection of essays is Owning It All. I asked him to read a paragraph from the title essay, Owning It All.
My father grew up on a homestead place in the Sagebrush Flats outside Silver Lake, Oregon. He tells of hiding under the bed with his sisters when strangers came to the gate. He grew up, as we all did in that country and era, believing that the one sure defense against the world was property. I was born in 1932 and recall a life before the end of World War II in which it was possible for a child to imagine that his family owned the world.
Can you elaborate on that feeling of owning it all, of owning the world?
Yes, I can. We lived in a place, Adel, Oregon, which at the time I grew up had no paved roads within about 50 miles. It had no power lines. We had an old Delco power plant, which we, you know, provided lights for the house. There was no telephone, and beyond us, at the end, we were the end of the road, essentially, from Warner Valley on at that time. There were wagon roads, and they didn't really go clear through the desert. It was 70 or 80 miles to any kind of habitation at all, where people lived on the great deserts beyond us. And as a consequence, we were extremely isolated, and we owned, you know, most of that valley. A few other people owned property in that valley, but we owned the lion's share of it. And in the BLM land, at that time it was Taylor grazing land, the government land beyond us for that 70 or 80 miles of high desert, we ran as if it was ours. And at that time, that was in the late 30s and early 40s, we essentially owned all the water out there. We owned 40 acres here and 40 acres there where there was a spring. So we treated all that property as if it were ours. And for a child growing up there, it was as if you owned the world. Everything in all directions was essentially yours. It was a great feudal kingdom, and there was really a sense of great security from the world and great isolation and great proprietorship.
Okay, great security and great isolation. Let's talk a little bit about the isolation. You were cut off from culture. I mean, aside from magazine subscriptions, you really didn't have access to probably some of the literature you're interested in, maybe movies.
No, there was nothing like that. No movies. I can remember going to Eugene while I was, you know, this was years and years later when I was in my early 30s, going to Eugene and just going up there and watching movies for about 3 days. And I remember watching the first movie I'd seen in about 2.5 years was Dr. Zhivago. When I went to Eugene, and it just blew me out of the chair, you know. I couldn't believe this thing. I wept and screamed and, you know, so on and so forth. And it was a tremendous experience. I'd never seen a widescreen movie at that point. And books and that sort of thing were also, you know, there was no sense of any kind of literary community around you. When I left in 1967, a man who was a dear friend of mine came over to help me pack up and leave, and I had a lot of books, and we were putting all these books in boxes, and he looked at me at one point and said, you know, Bill, if you read all these things, you'd really be smart, wouldn't you? And I have no idea what he thought I was doing with all those books, you know, but I really, you know, there was really no one that you to share those things with. It's true. The town where he lived, Adel, I once picked up a copy of Oregon Historical Names, and I saw the name Lonely. And I thought, my God, how would you like to live in a place called Lonely? And I looked down and said, former name of Adel, which was the place where I was living at the moment. So it was very isolated, yes.
You were heir to the ranch. Did you want to be the heir? Did that make you feel good?
Well, it was more complicated than that. There was, you know, it was a large family, and And many of us were heir to it. It was we were third generation by my time, and I was one of the principal heirs, certainly, and I was one of the people who stayed there. A lot of the heirs did not stay there and went off to other lives, and they clearly were less interested in preserving that property than I was. But yeah, it made me feel good in the sense that finally, once I got back on the ranch and once I understood how things were done and once I got to the point where I had jobs and had a lot of responsibility connected to it, then it was this great thing. I've said in the writing, it was the greatest plaything I ever had in my life, and I'm sure that's true. It was fun all day long for years to be able to manipulate, land and water and crops and men and equipment and all this stuff. It was just like you were playing chess with the world in a sense, and it was a great challenge. But after a while, it began to also it ran out, and it became less interesting for one thing, and it also began to see that in our manipulation of the world, the things we were doing to the land and the water and so on and so forth, we were destroying a lot of things. We thought at the time that we were, as I've said in the book, that we were doing God's work. We were making the world right. We were fixing it up. We were straightening it out. We were correcting God's errors, nature's errors, if you will. And of course, what we were doing was destroying the natural ecology of the place just as rapidly as we could go. And it was finally, after about 7 or 8 years of the kind of work that I've talked about, we began to have all kinds of kind of man-made natural disasters. Suddenly, we killed off all the coyotes, poisoned them, shot them from airplanes, all kinds of things. Suddenly, we had a huge explosion of field mice that destroyed about 4,000 acres of alfalfa, because all the natural predators were gone. Things of that nature just kept happening. Some of the prime peatland in the bottom of the valley, wonderful land, peat 8 feet deep, suddenly began to show signs of salinity. And we suddenly began to have to use fertilizer and begin to have to do all kinds of things to compensate for the mistakes that essentially we'd unknowingly made while we thought we were bringing the world, right, while we thought we were straightening it up, making it perfect. I go back to that ranch now and drive around on it, and it looks pretty much the same as it did 20 years ago, 19 years ago when I left. People who've run it since haven't changed it very much, and it's okay. I'm delighted to see it the way it is, but I think I'd be much more delighted if we'd never touched it at all, if it were all still tule ground and swamps and the great rafts, flights of V's of water birds were still coming in and out of there the way they were when I was a child.
William Kittredge is my guest, and his latest collection of essays is called Owning It All. You sold the ranch in 1967, and I was wondering if you felt guilty at all about selling it. In one of your essays, you say that there was a family rule, and the rule was, what's good for the property is good for you. So I imagine it was a very difficult decision to sell the property to somebody else.
Well, there was a lot of division in the family about that. Some of us had clearly gotten over that family rule by that time and no longer necessarily believed that. Others, I think, still held to that notion, but we had all by that time, I think, realized that an ethic that somehow establishes property as the primary thing in the life of a family is really going to be enormously divisive before it's over. When property becomes the primary thing on which you base everything else, including love and including various kinds of attachments and so forth, you're going to drive people apart before you're done, and that's what happened to us. And we ended up quite divided, I think. And everybody was relieved to make their getaway. I think finally, at the end, it had become by that point untenable because of that of the nature of our relationships were all determined by what's good for the property, what's good for the property. I mean, if your marriage suffered a little bit, so you can patch up your marriage, you can't patch up the property. It was the general run of things and the way things were thought about in our family, I think, for the most part.
When you sold the land, you went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop. You sold the land knowing that you wanted a different kind of life, that you wanted more time to write. How did you start writing?
Well, I went to Oregon State College in Corvallis in the early 50s, late 40s and early 50s, and lucked into a class from Bernard Malamud, who had just published The Natural, and finally they had him teaching four classes of comp, and finally they let him teach one class of creative writing, and I took the first class he taught there, and because I'd started reading some books, that great explosion that happens sometimes to people. My junior year in college, I was this ranch kid. And I took a American literature class from a man named Herbert Childs and read Thoreau and Emerson and was just kind of vamped by all that stuff. And suddenly I thought, wow. And then I read Hemingway and I was just knocked out of my chair. And then I thought, when this guy Malamud got to teach a creative writing class, I thought, well, I'll take that. And I did. He and I didn't get along at all. I didn't want to write the kinds of stories that I now tell my students to write, which he was telling me to write. But he got me hooked. And I got out of college and I tried to write a little bit. And always for the next 10 years when I wasn't writing, I thought I'd better write. This, you know, I kept thinking, you know, this eventually someday will be my life. And I was really kind of in emotional trouble at about the age of 32 when I said one day, in fact, it was the day after Thanksgiving, that I better sit down and do this if I'm ever going to do it, which I did. And that was about, I think, 64. And by the time we sold the ranch at 67, I had published two or three things and was pretty much convinced that I this really was the life I want. I got out of the ranch with enough money to either go to graduate school or get back in the ranch business in some limited way. I chose to go to graduate school, and I've never regretted it. People say, don't you wish you were back on the ranch? You know, kind of, I think, reflecting the great romantic notion that most Americans have about that life. And all I can say is, nope, never for a moment do I wish I was back on the ranch. I always say, you know, if I was, I'd be feeding cows right now. And as a matter of fact, right at this moment while recording this program, had I not made that decision, I'd probably be out in Warner Valley pitching hay. I'm glad I'm here.
Well, I think your subject as a writer became reexamining the myths of the West and then writing the story of the West as it is now.
I really believe so. In other words, one of the things that I started with, as I say, we all believed we were doing God's work in fixing up the world and the world was there for our use and all of those, you know, common elements of the mythology of the American West. I believed that for a long time. I went through a real period of transition in the later years there at the ranch and even after I began to write until I began to see that so many elements of that mythology had led us to make some terrible mistakes. At that point, I had to think my way through all that stuff and write my way through all that stuff until finally I came out at the far end, really thinking the mythology of the West, the Western, which is really a kind of America mythology, a mythology of conquest and takeover. I've described it as, you know, as a really racist, sexist, imperialist mythology that controlled, you know, most of America's conduct up until, say, the Second World War or after the Second World War, perhaps even up to the Vietnam War, was really an immoral mythology, and I really truly believe it was, and one that led to repression and genocide and misuse of the land. A lot of the ecological problems we've got now are a result of that. A great many of the problems we have today are a result of living by that mythology. Fortunately, it seems to me that's changing very rapidly. I'm in Seattle right now in a town which I think really believes a lot in ecology, and it's all over. You know, it's in the last 20 years it's changed greatly, and suddenly we're beginning to see that we have to change. We have to tell ourselves a new story. And one of the things I really believe is that human conduct is mostly determined by the kinds of stories we tell ourselves and the kinds of stories we try to live out. And it seems to me that old story of the Western is a story that thank God we're learning to no longer try to live. We're learning to abhor it, and we're learning to try to live a new story, which is can be called something like stay home and take care of things rather than go out and conquer things. And that seems enormously important to me.
Well, let's talk about some of the old myths and some of the new stories after we take a short break. And my guest is William Kittredge, and his latest collection of essays is called Owning It All. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is essayist and fiction writer William Kittredge. He grew up on a cattle ranch, but sold it to become a writer and professor. Now he writes about the myths of the American West and the American West as it is today. His most recent books include Owning It All, a collection of essays, and The Last Best Place, which is an anthology of Montana writing, which he co-edited with Enoch Smith. He's also written a series of westerns under the pseudonym of Owen Rountree. Kittredge now lives in Montana, but he's joining us today from KUOW in Seattle. One of the myths that you've written about, you call this our enfranchising myth, the great Western myth of the holy and innocent hero coming from the wilderness into town to slay the dragon, and then he rides away like a movie star. That's now you actually write westerns under the pseudonym of
I did for
Roundtree.
A while. Yes,
yeah. Was it to subvert that old myth in any way that you started writing the westerns?
Well, I think two or three things. It wasn't a completely pure impulse. I wrote it to make money for one thing, and another thing. I wrote it with someone else, a man named Stephen M. Krauser, who's a very fine writer himself, and we were really interested in writing a kind of new version of the Western in a way, kind of subverting it slightly. One of our heroes is a heroine, is a woman, gunfighter woman, if you will. And in fact, that series of books, the Cord novels, have been written about as self-reflexive westerns, if you will, self-reflexive genre stories in which they begin to look at the genre itself and make the genre examine itself a little bit. And we were clearly pretty interested in doing that. They're very modernist westerns, if you will. But at the same time, I think the primary impulse I had was really understanding the story. I felt like I had to write the things to understand how they worked, and it was a great help to me. It really was very revealing. We wrote 9 of them, and we finally quit writing them simply because we got tired, I think, because we felt we understood, you know, the genre and how it worked, and we're no longer interested in really, I guess, playing around with it anymore. It was fun to do for a while, and then it became labor, and at that point we quit.
You know, it seems to me that nowadays a lot of people want to trade myths. In other words, that you see a lot of Easterners who want to, like, live out the pioneer myths and go west and fit into maybe one of the myths that you left.
Oh, you sure do. You know, Montana's full of people who are coming out and buying property and building log houses and trying to plug into, you know, this mythology all the time. And you see Montanans immediately who think the hunting and fishing isn't any good anymore or whatever, or that things have, you know, become, I don't know, too corporate or something. They all want to move to Alaska or Australia, or I guess the last A would be Antarctica or someplace to escape, to get away. Sure, I believe that, you know, you're very correct.
Well, what's it like for you when you meet transplanted Easterners, for instance, coming to Montana, and trying to enact out what might really be a fantasy of the West?
Well, you have to believe, one, that the fantasy's kind of silly. And you go down to some place like Jackson or Cody, and you see these people striding around in cowboy boots with big hats and silver buckles, and it's ridiculous, of course. On the other hand, you know, the upside of it, or the positive side of it, is that all these people are coming and have always come to try to find a home, to try to find a place where they can live a coherent life, and often in a place where they can live in some relationship to nature, to the natural world, which isn't completely skewed in some sort of way. There are many, you know, I think literally crazy manifestations of all this. There are a lot of survivalists, for instance, in Montana, who are not my favorite people in the world. They really want to set up barricades and you know, kind of hold guns on everybody who comes near them. That's clearly a lunatic response. But there are a lot of good people coming out to try to make their homes. Most of the people I know, not most of the people, but two-thirds of the people I know, the writers in Montana, are not natives. There are natives like Jim Welch and Ivan Doig and people like that. But there's so many others like Tom McGuane and Richard Hugo and myself, who, you know, did not grow up in Montana. So it's really a mixed bag, but I don't think there's some great separation between inlanders and outlanders, essentially. We're all looking for a good home, you know.
You've written that regional art is the most important art because it's mostly the only art which is useful in our efforts to know ourselves. Do you think of your writing as a form of regional art?
Yeah, and, you know, there are lots of silly arguments about regional art and so on and so forth. So Tom McGuane recently quoted Jim Harrison saying he wasn't even sure there was an American art. But I really believe, when I say regional art, I really believe that art that springs from a place, from a locality, from a set of mores and a bunch of people in some particular place is the only art that ever for me really works. And when you try to imagine a national art, for instance, the United States, and we end up with, I don't know what, television, I guess, or something. And clearly it becomes so amorphous, it's very hard to identify. You know, I don't know what a national art would be in this country, but I really do know what a variety of regional arts are, which I admire enormously. And the Northern Rockies, Northeast, Boston, it seems to me, has its own regional tenor. There couldn't be anything more regional, probably, than the Upper East Side of New York, you know, of Manhattan Island.
Mm-hmm.
those are really regional, I think, and very specific, and create wonderful art because of it.
Well, you've written that the art of a region begins to come mature when it's no longer what we think it should be. And I'd like to know how you think that applies to your own writing.
Well, I think that in my own writing, I'm trying to explore things that were not, I think, the expected thing we would find written about. And I don't really think about it much in terms of my own writing. I'm not quite that self-conscious. In terms of other people's writing, I think of a novel like Housekeeping by Marilynne Robinson, which I think is a wonderful book. And it's also a very Western book. It's written about Sandpoint, Idaho. Marilynne grew up in Coeur d'Alene and Sandpoint. I think a book like that, which is a complete surprise, we would not have expected that book from a Westerner, is a sign that the writing about the place is no longer in the hip pocket of the mythology. That book doesn't seem to have much to do with the mythology, one way or the other. I think a book, Certain Parts of a River Runs Through It by Norman MacLean, work in the same way. When he says in the first line of that book, "In my family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing," you have to stop and say, "What way? Well, you know, how is that? That's not the first line of a book about the West. Wait a minute, we don't talk about religion in the West." You know, that sort of thing. Though that exploration of all the variety of variousness of life, which lies outside the parameters of the mythology about the West, for instance, in the West, is a sign that suddenly the writing is beginning to become mature and to not be just a kind of pocket mythology in response to a pocket mythology of some kind or another.
I'm always interested when somebody makes a big change in their life, like you did when you sold the ranch and went to school and then became a university teacher and became a professional writer. What happens to their family? Does their family stay together? I know you were married. I think you had a child or children at the time you sold the ranch and started to write professionally. If you don't mind my asking, did your family stay together through that change?
No, it certainly did not. I think that I think everybody, you know, in terms of having agendas and I really believe people live their lives like stories. I believe we come to recognitions and insights just like they do in stories, and we respond to those recognitions and insights. And I think that people who start off life, say it as I did when I got married to my wife at 21, sharing pretty much a view of the world, and suddenly at 35. We find out that we don't share that view of the world anymore, and we go our separate directions. And that's what happened in my family. It was very, very emotionally painful. I mean, it was really, you know, I don't want to say a tragedy, but it sure hurt a lot of people's feelings. I'll put it that way. And I think that happens a lot. I think that one of the things that we can do that's good for us all, which we didn't know enough to do in those days, obviously, was to objectify this whole business of coming to recognitions and insights about our life, that's what we're, as human beings, most often doing, is trying to understand our lives by coming to these kinds of insights and to understand that's a normal, healthy, good thing to do, that we don't have to, you know, plug our lives into one track and stay there for the rest of our life. I'm writing a book right now for Simon & Schuster called Hole in the Sky, which is about changing lives, essentially. The discussion we're having right now is part of the argument of that book. And one of the things my editor said a long time ago, he said, I don't know about selling books about Montana or Nevada or Eastern Oregon, but he said, I do know I can sell books about people trying to make some sense out of how to manage the changes in their life, the really fundamental changes that come. And it is a very troubling process, but I think that it's a very normal process and a very necessary process if we're to, as a society and as individuals, to grow and mature and change and proceed.
We know earlier in the interview you said that you think it's time that we start telling ourselves a new story, and you were referring to the kind of exploitation that happened in the West and how it's time to create new stories about using the land without exploitation. When you make a big change in your life, do you think of it as also creating a new story, and does the story that you plan to live out occur to you before you start living it, or does the story unfold as your life begins to change?
I think both, you know, obviously. I think that when you make some major change, you probably want to have some rationale for it. You want to think you're doing something positive, that you're moving in some kind of correct direction. I think that you know, the idea of living a new story in the West is a very necessary thing. I think it's happening. I don't think there's much any of us can do about it. It's just occurring. We're starting to to understand that we have to take care of the world, we have to stay home, this is all there's going to be, there's nothing left to conquer, and, you know, if we wreck things, we're going to have to live with the wreckage, which wasn't always true in the West. You could always move on, you know, up until about 50 years ago or 40 years ago, and I think that's true in our own lives, too, that in this process of changing our lives and moving on, we need to really also be aware of damage control and not proceed with some kind of absolute heedlessness, which oftentimes we did, which I did in my middle 30s. I think I was pretty heedless. I just had this notion of what I wanted to do, and I was just, you know, heading for it, and I did, and probably hurt myself and other people.
Yeah, but you know, probably if you weren't heedless about it, you wouldn't have been able to do it.
I
mean, to make such a big change and to uproot yourself so dramatically, unless you take really drastic action and don't think too long about the consequences, it's awfully hard to do.
I agree with that completely. So I have no answer. I think, you know, that finally you just have to, you have to move, and you have to say, this is where I'm going and this is what I have to do, and I'm sorry, but here I go. And at that point, you just have to tip your hat and take the consequences.
So how much land do you live on now? Do you have any land?
None whatsoever. I don't have a square inch. And that's fine with me. I've made a rule in my life, you know, no more lawns. And I suppose that goes back to the whole ranching business. Once there was all that land, and I feel no need for it whatsoever anymore. And that's just exercise for my life. And I love, you know, being on the land, being around the natural world, and I even love going to my friend's house and giving them advice who own pieces of property and giving them advice which they never take about what they ought to do about, you know, some farming problem. But as far as doing it myself, I feel no need to do it at all anymore.
So it's good enough to be around land. You don't have to own the land.
That's the way I feel. Yeah. And I really don't at this point anymore in my life, and this is not some you know, goofy religious principle or something, I just don't feel any urge to own it. And I'm glad to be there. I'm glad it's there. I'm glad it's you know, when it does, I'm glad it looks good. And I hope more of it is taken care of, and that's enough. The idea that I have to own a piece of land that I can go over and dig a hole in or something is just not present in me anymore. And I don't think that makes me something. I just think that's, you know, a result of historical circumstances, my own life.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us about your life and about your writing. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been William Kittredge, and his recent books include Owning It All, which is a collection of essays, and We Are Not In This Together, a collection of stories, both published by Grey Wolf Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.